Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there and welcome to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Coming up on the programme today, in a moment, myself and Dave will be discussing some of the current business headlines from the local and national papers.
In the business of this week, Don Harris from Talkback is here to talk to us about the business of coaching with a focus on employee engagement and in-house communication using empathy and mindful listening.
David Bell from the HR department will be here after that for his regular look at HR issues. And this week, David's talking to me about bullying in the workplace and what to do about it. Finally then, Alana Jeffries will join me to chat about the success of her network marketing business, Forever Living. Now, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories this evening, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get us anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Well, Dave, we're going to chat about the current business headlines in just a couple of minutes, but it's been a busy few days for Nearby Business.
Yeah, I was like Brian Green in the last couple of days. I was on the road for Nearby Business. Yesterday, I was in the Helix at DCU, where the Cyber Summit took place. And you remember about 3 weeks ago, we had Paul Dwyer here of the organisation.
Very interesting guy. Yeah,
really good guy, very brilliant speaker. And he spoke yesterday, and there was 2,000 people there, delegates at the Cyber Summit, and three stages. Ages, a breakout space and all that kind of thing, some great speakers and panel discussions and so on, and it ended up with an interview with Ed Snowden via satellite, which kept breaking down, a sort of a link that kept breaking down. But we're going to have a lot more on that next week in the programme, which we're going to put together with lots of footage we took yesterday, audio, and we'll be playing that out next week on our programme here at 6 o'clock.
Look forward to that. Now, you also went on then to a Brexit briefing today.
Yeah, this is run by the Department of Foreign Affairs this morning, and they originally planned this, they called it a summit, a get together for those who were interested in becoming Brexit ready. Lots of different companies were there. It originally was planned for Croke Park, and I think the people who were subscribing to it, like myself, and got along to see it, grew and grew and grew. I think there was about 1500 people there this morning, and they moved it to the National Convention Centre.
Oh, right.
And a very impressive building. If you haven't been in it, I've been in it a couple of times. It's a really nice place down there on the Keys. And Brexit Ready Summit was there this morning. It was opened by Leo Varadkar and then the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, who were late. They were 25 minutes late, and it actually put a lot of people off because a lot of people
delayed
had to leave
the whole
at
morning.
The end. But Leo, I believe the excuse was he had to go to see a school in his constituency, which is subject to this problem that's going on at the moment with the building regulations and so on. So he was late for that, and there was people there that didn't quite break out in a slow hand clap, but nearly did.
Right. Okay.
And that was there, and a few other people speaking there. Some audio from that as well, which we'll be including next week in the programme. So very interesting pieces from that, and the stakeholders, those from the government agencies had little sort of stalls, for the want of a better word, outside, and they were from the NSAI and the various different agencies, Enterprise Ireland and so on, which helped the people with the preparation for Brexit. But the difficulty, the overlying difficulty with this thing was nobody knows what's going to happen yet.
Yeah.
So it's kind
it's
of we're preparing for something, you know. And Simon Coveney actually used an analogy. He said when we did the first one of these, we did it in Galway, and Storm Callum was coming. He said we arrived in the city of Galway and there was sandbags everywhere, and everybody was prepared, but the storm actually didn't come. So he says that's what we really need. There's sort of an analogy we really need to do.
Hopefully the storm of Brexit
storm
won't
of
come
Brexit
as well.
Come. We'll be a bit of that next week as well. We've kind of a sort of a special program on those two things, and that'll be going out at 6 o'clock on Thursday next week.
Okay, looking at what's in the paper in the last couple of days, Dr. Martin puts their best foot forward.
Do you have a pair of Docs? I had them years ago.
Well, never had a pair of Docs.
Too nice, you see. You wouldn't wear anything as
I'm from Artane. Yeah, that's the difference, you see.
Well, strong sales in Europe and the Middle East have boosted profits as the UK and Ireland firm Dr. Martin's earnings grew 33% to 50 million in the year to March, with sales up 20%. And the Northamptonshire based company, most famous for its distinctive boots, said it had seen double digit growth in revenues and profits in all regions. It started production in Northampton in 1960, although most of its boots are now made overseas, with 70,000 a year are still made in the UK factory. Dr. Dr. Martens makes more than half of its revenues from its most recognisable product, the 1460 boot. I didn't know it was called that before. And its sister product, the 1461 shoe. The company said it sold 40% of its revenues came from selling directly to customers. And over the year, the company, which is owned by a private equity firm, Permira, opened...
They always have difficult names, those
they
private equity
do.
Events.
They do. It's probably made up of a few different corporations.
Indeed.
But they opened 25 new stores, including 9 in the UK, giving a total of 91 stores. And they have one in Dublin, a branded store in Duke Street in Dublin. The company said it had spotted a number of high-profile people sporting its wares, including David and Brooklyn Beckham, Kanye West, Pharrell Williams and Cardi B. I don't know Cardi B, but I know the rest of them.
Yeah.
In the past year, the company appointed a new chief executive whose previous job was at the retro style homeware fashion brand Kat Kitson. Dr. Martens Air Cushion Sole was developed by the Munich based Dr. Mertens and Dr. Funk. Now, you'd want to be careful when you're saying that after having a glass of Barville.
You would.
And the UK patent rights were sold to R. Giggs, Griggs Group. The footwear that emerged from their collaboration was initially sold as a work boot, but was taken up by the early skinhead youth movement in the 1960s. The boots became popular with punks in the 1970s and had a resurgence when Britpop emerged in the 1990s. Great product and iconic British
story.
Product, I would say. But
wonder how they'll fare out with Brexit.
Yeah, I remember when I was in school in the late 70s, that became the kind of trendy. Guys were all wearing the boots, the Dr. Martens.
You probably
boots.
Wouldn't have been allowed to wear them to school.
Yeah, but they were black shoes, you see. I think they kind of got over it that way, you know.
Maybe. Okay, now a Dublin-based software company has signed a long-term agreement with SAS.
Datalex, the Dublin-based travel software firm, has announced a long-term agreement with the Scandinavian airlines SAS. The agreement will see Datalex support the airline in its digital transformation strategy with new distribution capability and merchandising and order management across all sales channels. The Datalex platform will support the dynamic shopping pricing and promotion of offers based on data collection and intelligence to deliver a personalised retail experience to around 30 million SAS customers. And they said, we have the ambition to deliver a digital customer experience second to none, and Datalex commercial platform is a great complement to our existing digital capabilities and supports our business and IT strategy, said Mats O. Eklund, VP and Commercial IT and Development Manager at SAS. There you go.
The business of... on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
In the business of this week, Don Harris from Talkback is here to talk to us about the business of coaching with a focus on employee engagement and in-house communication using empathy and mindful listening. Now, Don is actually sitting beside me here. That's a mouthful. What is Talkback?
It is a bit of a mouthful, you're right, Dave. And thank you very much. Delighted to be here with you and Declan. Thanks a lot. Yeah, okay. So mindful listening really is about really paying attention to the person in front of you with all your senses, if you like. So you're listening with your eyes, you're listening with your ears, you're looking at their body language, and you're making them feel entirely important in front of you. Because it is now the case, unfortunately, that a lot of people don't get listened to very often at work. In fact, they almost are disregarded. And then that becomes a bit of a problem because they feel that. They feel like they're overlooked. They feel like they're not included. So I got very interested in the whole idea of coaching and looking into this whole business of listening better to people. Empathy is the other way of terming it, and active listening, if you like. All of those things are about giving a chance to be listened to, and mental health has become a big thing, and the difficulty at work with mental health is becoming a real topic where it was not talked about before.
And are these things really being talked about in the workplace, and in what context? I mean, some people might feel exposed or challenged by that. You know, they may not want the boss or the manager to know that stuff about them, if you like. So how do you deal with that, Don? How do you get people to open up?
Yeah, well, you've nailed it there in that very question. The topic has been talked about, but the people who are maybe involved in the situation or worried about their own mental health are not talking about it. So there's a big difference between mental health and mental illness. And, you know, you can go down a road, big road there. But even depression and that type of mental situation, I don't even like calling it illness, is part of looking after people's mental health and their well-being. So engagement in companies nowadays really does look at the whole idea of people being looked after better, and there's some very good companies in the world and in Ireland who do that very well, and there's some who do it very badly. So it's a way of including your people and wanting to get the best for them. And you know what? If you get the best for them, you will get the best for the company out of them.
Is it hard to convince CEOs, owner managers of that?
I wouldn't say convince is the word. It's to even make them aware that it exists,
right,
is a difficulty. My work has been a lot about getting to the truth and getting a bit of honesty from people. And that's not easy for people to do with their bosses or even their line managers, because nobody likes telling the truth for the reasons you've just pointed out there. They're afraid of being pinpointed, and maybe it will affect their career down the road. So the business is really about helping the CEO and any of the senior management to understand there is a bit of an issue here, even if you don't realise it, and you may be part of it, I'm afraid, sir. And you have to kind of broach that subject with them.
And, I mean, you're obviously, you must start at both ends, if you know what I mean, because you need to speak to the employees, the people working in the organisation, to determine what the issues are. But then in order to do that, you obviously have to have the permission of the owner or the CEO.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that you're starting it from both ends?
Well, there you go. That is a sensitive part of the conversation. And there's a lot of trust needs to be established, both with the employees, particularly actually with the employees, and then giving the chief executive or whoever has asked you, maybe it's the HR director, some hard facts, which they may not want to hear. But generally, they do want to hear it, but they know themselves that they're not necessarily the right people to ask the questions. So they bring in a third party like me to start talking about it.
So how do you get involved? Who brings you to the party? You know,
well, a lot of my work comes by referral of projects I have done. I've worked in aviation with an airline, and I worked with pilots and ground staff and people, and that became a whole project, lasted 6 years in the end, because there was a lot of work of finding out what was going on. So often it's a question of somebody says, it might even be in a boardroom, but in a conversation somewhere, we've a bit of a problem, but I don't know what it is. We can't get to the bottom of what it is. But things, our profits are sliding, or, you know, the innovation isn't coming through, the creativity isn't coming through. We're not quite sure why, and we need to do some focus groups. Or very often they say to themselves, we need to find out, we need to do a survey. So part of my conversation is, you know, when have you talked and listened to your own people? Oh, we sent out a survey. No, when have you actually listened or talked to your people? And they keep deflecting it, as in they think, oh, we've... And I say, it's you. You as the boss, you as the senior HR director, need to also be engaging with your own people to understand, because they want to engage with you, and sometimes they might feel they can't. So the conversation can be very much about, as you've pointed out, the staff themselves, the employees themselves, and getting the bottom of what their issues are. Because if an employee is not looking forward to going to work, there's some reason for that. And it's not necessarily all within the workplace. It could be outside the workplace as well. So you need to get the bottom of that and get them on your side.
And the techniques that we talked about there in the opening remarks, I mean, engaging the employees, looking at the in-house communication and using the empathy and mindful listening. Mm. How does that work in practice when you start engaging with the employees? How do you, in a practical way?
Well, first of all, you're introduced by the senior management, and you said there's a guy probably.
Is there ever any suspicion there? Like, did they say this guy's come in now and he's kind of finding out from us?
Absolutely, there is.
Confession booth job.
Absolutely, there is. So there is trust that needs to be established, and that takes a while.
Yeah.
So it has to be a buy-in culture, not a mandatory thing. You can't force anybody to talk to you, and it's the wrong thing to do. I do remember a conversation with one particular person, and this is the type of positioning situation that can be so wrong, where one of the chief people I was talking to, I don't want to exactly pinpoint, said to me, you want to watch this particular person, and they named a couple of people saying, no, he might be difficult, that might be difficult. So of course then you're given up a situation where you already
have a bias.
And you're thinking, no, hold on. So you can't allow that to happen. You've got to go in with your own views and make your own opinion, gather your own opinion. So I do remember having a conversation with one particular gentleman, and I said to him as we were sitting down, first time I've ever met him, I said, I wasn't really looking forward to this meeting, to be honest. And he said to me, well, why is that? I said, well, to be honest, I was told you were a bit grumpy. I was going to be difficult. I said, well, you know, what makes you think that? Well, I think it's probably just because you speak your mind. By the way, I don't have any problem with that at all. Anyway, we got on absolutely famously from that moment. So it's a question of sometimes confronting it straight up and finding out yourself. And a similar type of starting conversation techniques, if you like, with people.
Okay. So when you do that, you've got through the process and then you were building up a whole bank of knowledge and a bank of information. Mm. How do you relay that back to the management team or the CEO or the owner?
Well, it's interesting. I do a lot of recording, a little one-to-one interviews, and I don't ask people's names. I don't need the name. But I do get the recording. So when it's an off-site recording, people don't always recognise voices, and that's good. So, and anyway, I don't play them. But I do then transcribe what they've said, or I listen back myself and then just make notes without actually transcribing word for word. Emails come into it, but what I never do is ever give feedback on the day that I've met people. I wait maybe 3 or 4 days to gather this information and then say, this is what I've heard over the last 3 or 4 days in some of the groups or the one-to-one meetings that I've had. You might be interested in that. Now, when I was working with one of the airlines, a lot of this was compiled late at night with pilots and engineers and people. So I would be popping off an email actually for that session, but there'd be 60 people involved, so it
right.
didn't matter.
Wouldn't be able to.
And I'd say, I've discovered this and I discovered, yeah. Would you know that? And very often I'd get a note back, an email back overnight, and I'd finish it about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was a nighttime operation. And I'd get an email back by 11 o'clock and say, no, we actually didn't know that. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. So that was part of the gathering of the feedback. And it turned out to be very, very useful information. So useful for the organisation that the whole thing lasted 6 years in the end. It was only going to be a group of about 50 or 60 people and went on to be 460 plus. So
How do you know when you're done? I mean, you said that lasted 6 years, and obviously there was a big enough job to be done there, I'm assuming, or maybe just
have measurement.
Yeah, and you slowly, slowly.
So if the engagement, in this case, there was a large global survey. So the engagement figures go up in the way that it's measured. And in our case, in the one I was working at, it went from 47% to 74%. We knew it was working. Now, you can't actually see it in a tangible situation with people who, you know, are maybe relating differently with relating to the management differently, but they are relating to you differently, and you find out more and more things, and then they just want to talk to you. They actually ask. And then the main thing is fix the things that are brought up. If somebody says, well, this has been going on, that's going on, you know, can you get that fixed? And it's been going on for ages. If you can get those things, they're usually lots of little things fixed bit by bit by bit. That's a big measurement.
And can you? I just think of what you're saying there. Can you end up being a conduit or a channel for sort of grievances? Really, you know, on a kind of a fairly big scale, would it be? Is there friction then, or you know, I know that's not where you're coming from, but could it gather momentum in that direction?
It could if it wasn't addressed. That is the thing. I'm there to try and assist and get at what the information is and what the truth and what maybe the issue is. I had one case of a girl who was definitely committed to the company but really found herself between a rock and a hard place as being able to progress in her career, and she opened up to me on a couple of things and then gave me permission, which is terribly, terribly important. Gave me permission to raise this with somebody at the right time. And I had the opportunity to raise the particular concern. And I was delighted then a few months later when I went back and I found that she'd achieved something that she needed to achieve. She moved. She got employee of the quarter. I'm not great on that type of scheme, by the way, but that's what was their measurement. And she became employee of the year in that particular company. And she was absolutely thrilled. Now, she could have been lost to the company because she was definitely thinking, I'm not sure where I want to stay here any longer. So there is an opportunity to fix things for people. And you know what? As I mentioned earlier on, everybody wants to be listened to. And they don't talk about things at work. None of us talk about things at work. And you don't know who to trust. And by the way, that applies to management as well. They don't.
Yeah.
So a CEO, a financial director, chief technical officer, anybody like that, head of engineering, they don't have people to talk to either. So a professional coming in who they can actually relate to and build a rapport with, they're happy to do. And then you've got to have a skill then to know how to use that information correctly to both assist them and for the benefit of the company as well, because after all you've been paid for the company.
Yeah.
But what you can't do is break the bond.
Sure. Why do you do it, Don?
Right. It's interesting. I started this a long time ago. I became a coach back in 2008, 2009. I became very interested in this whole thing of people. So that was part of it. And then in 2014, at the end of the year, I had a major medical upheaval myself, where I managed to get a burst bowel and a burst appendix in the same day. So I was fairly dodgy for a couple of days. I was told, my wife's poor lady was told, this could be tricky now. And if he gets not too far from where we are now, if he gets an infection, we won't be able to do anything. Anyway, pulled through very well. So it meant I had a colostomy bag for a year or so after that. The companies I was working with were terrific. Didn't make any difference to them. I was back in working with them all in 2 or 3 months. And you can operate very successfully with a colostomy bag. But those few months, those few weeks made me think about my future, what I really wanted to do. So I started Coach Talk, which is the other side of the business. And that brought me much closer to dealing with people on one-to-ones and wanting to help people, wanting to make sure that I got the most out of my life. I love the quote by Abraham Lincoln. It's not the years in your life, it's the life in your years.
Yep.
And I thought to myself, well, what are you going to do now to get the best out of your life, and how much have you got left? So I just got on with things that I really wanted to do, and I'm still doing it.
It focuses the mind. Dave he probably wants to talk about radio, because Don is a little bit of a radio head as well.
Yeah, I found a photograph of you my pirate radio collection from 1983, and you were in the company, the elevated company of Rene and Renato. Now, you don't have to expand on that. I'd be looking for repentance if I was you on that one, be honest with you. What am I going
to
do with my life? It's all uphill from there, or downhill, which is it?
But maybe tell us. Singing waiter, as they turned out to be, but anyway.
Can you tell us a little bit about your history there you were 1983, you were Airtime Limited, and I'll go back maybe a little bit of your radio history.
Sure, as part of my background, I've always been terribly interested in radio, as it happened, and I know we all have a long term background going back a while, and I got the bug. So I had the opportunity to set up a company called Airtime in the pirate radio days, actually, and become a central hub for buying and selling radio time. And so I called the company Airtime.
Yep.
And that then went on through the 80s, and like everything had to come to an end at in 88, because that era of radio had to close down.
Had come to an end, yeah.
So I didn't really have any radio to deal with. But I did pitch then to get a contract to become the official central sales and marketing organisation, which became IRS. And that was in 1992. So very pleased with myself after a lot of effort. It was 10 years. I had to pull through Christmas 1991. No money at all. Sell the car. Scrape through. But we made it. Money went into the company. We got the contract in 1992. So I would have been the first CEO of a thing called Independent Radio Sales, or IRS, which is still going very strong, I'm delighted to say. And proper independent radio got off the ground and has flourished. And Airtime flourished separately. I still have Airtime Limited as a company, but Talkback and Coach Talk are the trading names out of that. But certainly my involvement with dealing with staff and people in radio has always made me close to the whole area, and I still love radio. So I was delighted to be invited in here, and thank you very much indeed. So yeah, that took a while, but a lot of radio stations, a lot of involvement, and even in those early days, the figures for advertising and local radio was pretty strong.
Great. Don Harris, thanks a million for taking the time to come in and talk to us.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Okay, and Don Harris's company, as you said there, it's Talkback and Coachback, and I believe you're going to have a podcast as well up and running shortly as well, Don. So we wish you the best of luck with that.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks a million for coming in to talk to myself and Dave today. Dave, before we get to the ad break, the ESB is to charge for its charging next year, is it?
Yeah, the ESB has confirmed its plans to start charging for the electric vehicle users for their use of public charging stations. However, the company has not yet set out what the charges might be. The move will be accompanied by further improvements to the public charging infrastructure, including the addition of new super-fast charging hubs. These hubs would cater for 2 to 8 vehicles charging simultaneously, offering drivers higher charging speeds, resulting in reduced charging times and faster journeys, a spokesman for the ESB said. The state-owned electricity provider said the introduction of fees in 2019 is necessary to fund the maintenance and development of the network. We will consult and engage with EV drivers and staff stakeholders in advance of fees being introduced, the ESB said. The ESB did announce plans in 2015 to introduce charges for the use of public EV charging stations, but later rolled back on it following a backlash from users and other stakeholders.
I think it's coming, as they say. And if you think about it logically, I mean, when we get to the point where everybody has an electric car and all the fossil fuel is gone, which is not that far away, I mean, all these fuel operators will now want to replace their pumps with charging points. Well, they'll want an income.
Yeah, just on the figures, I'm going to just two or three little figures here. But Ireland has promised from 2030 onwards to have 500,000 EVs. However, the target is seen highly ambitious, as just 7,000 are currently registered here. The uptake is growing, though, with 3,209 of those registered this year alone. So people are getting the message, although they're still afraid about the diesel thing. They're hanging on to the diesels, and hybrids are in the middle of those. But I actually know, it's, you know, the idea that I actually know somebody who has an electric car, whereas I didn't last year.
Yeah.
You know, and then you'll probably know two or three people, and the guy next door will have one. And
ultimately,
you know,
you'll have one yourself.
Yeah. So that's it, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting. And of course, in the budget recently, they maintained, from a business point of view, if you're an employee of a business, there's no BIK on having an electric vehicle for another 12 or months or 2 years as well. So, okay, great stuff. Now, coming up in the second part of the programme, in a couple of minutes, I'll be talking to David Bell from the HR department. This week, we're going to talk about bullying in the workplace and what to do about it. And later on, before we finish at about 10:45, Alana Jeffries will join me to chat about the success of her network marketing business, Forever Living. All of that to come on Nearby Business in the next half hour. Back in just a moment.
Download a podcast and catch up on your listening at near.ie.
Near FM 90.3.
This is Near FM.
And welcome back to Nearby Business. Don't forget, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show directly by text while we're on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get us anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business. #localbiz.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
David Bell from the HR department is with me now for his regular look at HR issues. This week, David, we're going to talk about bullying in the workplace and what to do about it.
Good evening.
How are you? What can be done about it, Dave?
Well, I suppose, look, it seems to be something that, despite all of the publicity and awareness campaigns and cases that people see, it does seem to be still an issue in the workplace. There's a number of different reasons. I suppose it is a difficult thing to deal with, particularly for smaller businesses. And often the problem is, I think, is that because people are unsure how to deal with it, it's not that they don't take it seriously, but they just don't know how to stop it or how to investigate it, how to deal with it, and it gets worse and worse. And I think that's one of the risks. So it's being able to sort of identify types of behaviour that go on, so that if someone does, an employee does raise issues, that they can say, well, that, you know, you don't make a quick judgment, but you could say, I could see where that could be, potentially could be perceived as bullying, and at least they should have then a process to follow, as you would with anything in the workplace. But I think first and foremost, there is an element of uncertainty. And to be perfectly honest, another thing I think which is unfortunate, and this is slightly off the topic, but might be relevant. Sometimes when there's management going on that might be involved in a disciplinary, or where there's a grievance taken by another employee about someone else or their boss, and there's a bit of pressure coming on someone from a disciplinary perspective, accusations of bullying get thrown around. And you know, you're not going to have a manager saying, well, I know what the definition of bullying is, and what you've just told me isn't bullying under the definition. People don't act like that. They automatically tend to back off if that's thrown around.
Sure.
So unfortunately, because of that, sometimes it's not taken perhaps as seriously as it should be, because it sometimes is seen as a defense mechanism to what people might consider reasonable management. So that's something as well, I think, that impacts on it.
And the old adage, the sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me, or words will never hurt me. I mean, it's not nowadays just about words, though. There's so many other types or so many other forms, I suppose, that bullying can happen nowadays as well. Can you go through a couple of those for us, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose, first of all, just one of the things that people, again, go back to my example earlier, you know, it is by definition a series of something. It's a repeat behavior. You know, everyone has flashpoints. Workplaces can be stressful. Projects need to be put on time. Deadlines are met. So there's often situations where voices might be raised at a meeting, or individuals might disagree about something that it could get out of hand. That's not bullying. You know, that is a one-off. It mightn't be very appropriate, and if there's, you know, it could still be an incident, but it's not bullying per se. Bullying does require more than one or two, you know what I mean? It's repeated behavior. So there has to be a certain amount of intention or lack of care, in other words. It's not something that just happens and you're being bullied. It really has to have a repeat. So just again, to reiterate that, it's sometimes people forget that.
Yeah.
But it generally is a cycle of situations. And yeah, it comes in different forms. So I suppose the classic one is this verbal, which would be, you know, intimidation, talking someone down, undermining someone at meetings, disregarding anything they've got to say, and just basically treating them in an inappropriate way over a significant period of time, or over a period of time repeatedly. I suppose physical would be the one that, and on the greater scheme of things, probably the least common in some ways, physical bullying, because that's nearly the easiest to prove, or to, if you have a witness and there's been a physical altercation, that is somewhat easier to investigate because you have witnesses, and maybe not as subtle as verbal, but that does obviously occur. But I'm certainly, the ones that I've dealt with, is rarely physical interaction. It's usually a mixture of verbal and then isolation, exclusion, you know, that sense that there's something going on and you're not included, or the person's not included. Team meetings, or you know, where there's even a social event or a gathering or an important meeting, and certainly situations I've seen, for example, where there's been people, we're all having a meeting in so-and-so, but you know, other people are excluded. Some, there may be a reason for it, because they may not be at the level that's required, but sometimes they are, and there's no explanation. And sometimes it's been done as a punishment, but it's not perceived as such, and it's not appropriate. So I think exclusion, that type of thing, can happen, and that happens quite a bit in the workplace.
We often talk about the policies and, you know, having things defined and all that. I'm sure in you know, medium to larger workplaces, there's a policy, there'd be a very clear procedure as to what you might do. But what about a smaller workplace or smaller organisation where perhaps it's the boss that's actually doing the bullying? What could or would happen in that sort of a scenario?
Yeah, well, you know, as you say, it depends on the person that you're dealing with. We're trying to draft policies. We try and address that by saying, look, you know, if there's only six of you and you don't have any per se managers, and everyone reports to you and you're the owner of the company, and someone has a complaint about you, what are they going to do? Where are they going to go? You know, so it is a real problem, and we sometimes look for outside intervention. So, you know, we often suggest that the policy allows for a third party to come in and investigate. So if the complaint is made against the owner of the business or the more senior person, that there is some capacity to bring someone in to deal with it outside, from outside, and they're independent and objective. And that does give some safeguard to the employees. It may be that they still won't do anything because they might want to do it, but at least if you have an option. And that's generally what we advise.
Yeah.
But if someone doesn't have a policy and has never thought about it, it is very difficult. Sometimes they might go to, if they're in an employer's representative, you know, they might be in a trade association or something like that. You know, we always suggest that they have someone in mind that is either an ex-employee, or it might have been a managing director, someone that has some connection with the business or the industry they're in, that would be respected and would be prepared to step in to be that person's superior for the purposes of that investigation or that complaint. But it is very difficult when you don't have the personnel.
And I suppose the reverse could perhaps be true as well, where, you know, the employee might be actually bullying the boss. Would that be practically
very
possible?
Very good point, and yeah. I think absolutely. When you talk about it, there is a perception and a presumption to some extent that it's all what we call downwards bullying, that it's the more senior people bullying or being inappropriate behaviour towards their juniors. And in fact, it's very often the other way around, and it's even more difficult then because there's a certain amount of pride. And also, if someone who is technically the manager or their superior is feeling that way, you know, they do probably think it's a sign of their inability to manage. And sometimes it's painted as such. So if they make sort of soundings to colleagues or to their own superior, it's often like, well, look, you need to manage that situation. Which isn't exactly very helpful because they're left then feeling, well, I can't do anything about it. If I put my hand up and make a complaint, I'm going to be the one who looks like I'm not doing my job. So, again, it is about education. It is about knowledge of what it is. And, you know, obviously the overriding factor here is no matter, and you know, this is the sort of cold hard truth for all employers and all businesses, they have a responsibility. Ultimately, where it catches them is if they ignore it, and someone ends up going on, you know, sick leave, or they leave and they take a case. That is one obviously issue. But there's also the health and safety, you know. So, you know, there is, as we all know, a primary responsibility to look after the health and safety of staff members and all employees. So, you know, there are different breaches of legislation that can come into play depending on how serious and what, if anything, was done. That is one of the big problems. And you know, I think it is still, unfortunately, one of those issues that will always be here. I you know, there's a lot that has been done, and I think things have improved, and employees know their rights much more, and employers probably know what to do and are much more capable and comfortable dealing with these things. But it still is definitely a big problem.
And in your experience, David, how widespread is bullying in the workplace? I mean, we know it goes on. Are there any figures collated, or do you have any feel for how widespread it is?
I think sort of, you know, unfortunately, because the nature of it, we tend to get a lot of our information from the UK and the US, just from a survey, because they just have the bandwidth. But, you know, there was a survey and it was in a blog I did that were over 60% of the people who replied to the questionnaire have been impacted by workplace bullying, and then there was one in the UK which said that over half the people who responded had been bullied in a workplace. Now, you know, that is obviously a significant number of people. If you're talking about over 50% of people in the workforce, a lot of people probably feel it's happening and aren't doing anything about it. And they're suffering in silence. That's another problem. But it does show you that I think it is widespread. You know, bearing in mind, I still think the idea of bullying is thrown out a bit too readily for me. You know, when you do get in behind it and you start to look at it, it is in often the case not actually bullying. I'm not saying it's acceptable, it's not bullying as defined. But even having said that, I still think there's a lot of behaviour in the workplace which shouldn't go on, and I think it does impact people. And again, you know, some people are more sensitive than others, and maybe not, you know, be a bit more susceptible to this, and that doesn't make it any better, you know.
Yeah, indeed. And as you said there, I think it's interesting because I was going to ask you that. Even though half or 60% of people say they've been bullied, I'd imagine the figure of people who actually do something about it is a lot less, as you said.
Exactly. And look, you know, as I said, the problem with it is it sometimes comes in, and sometimes people experience in that, you know, if we look at the downwards, for example, so there's management, so there's an issue has come up, or there's performance issues, and the manager feels that they have to be on top of it, they have to do a period of micromanaging, but none of that's communicated. They take it upon themselves, they don't explain it, or if they do explain it, they don't explain it well, or even if they explain it, the employee thinks that they are being picked on or selected for unfair treatment, etc. And that's sort of what happens, and that often gives rise to a bullying complaint, which statistically is a bullying complaint. Someone feels they're being bullied, but when it's investigated, it often, sometimes, is concluded that it's not bullying. It is management, and it might be tight management, as they say, or micromanagement, but there might be justification for it in certain circumstances. So, you know, again, the statistics probably suggest that it's happening, but it's the investigation. You know, if you ask me how many times have I seen it bandied around and has there been accusations made in one form or another versus how many were investigated fully and concluded, I'd say it's 1 in 10, if that. Right. You know, that actually went the whole way to a full investigation and a conclusion that there was or wasn't bullying. It normally sometimes indicates there's other issues there. Yeah. Not always. But I'm saying, so it is, the statistics, as we all know, can be flawed. But I do think it's an issue, and I think part of the problem is, going back to the point that you asked about, particularly in smaller businesses, the staff sometimes don't have a clue where to go.
Yeah.
And they don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
And they generally end up, you know, to be honest with you, most of them just end up leaving at some stage. And it's only afterwards that perhaps they might have a word, or they might write a letter, and it's a bit too late then at that stage. But you know what I mean, that sometimes does happen. So in the smaller businesses, it is very difficult because the impact of it is greater in a way because the people who are involved are working very closely together. It's something we've just touched on before. If you're in a bigger company, you can maybe move people around without punishing people. You know, location or department or something to try and to lessen the contact. But in a smaller business, it's very difficult.
Very difficult. And even the impact of losing one of four employees, it's sort of 25% of the staff gone. So it's a challenge from all sorts of angles.
And in that, the problem is it's due to the person who feels they're being bullied who goes.
Yeah,
not indeed. The other way around.
Not the other way around. Okay, David Bell, as usual, thanks a million for having a comprehensive look at bullying in the workplace and giving us some pointers as to what to do about it. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Declan.
Thanks a million. David Bell there from the HR department, having a look at issues from the employer's point of view. David, the story that's in the papers in the last couple of days, interest rates are likely to remain stable until at least the summer of 2019.
Yeah, this affects us all really if you have a mortgage or whatever. The European Central Bank kept its policy unchanged as expected today, staying on course to end bond purchases by the end of December and raise rates sometime after next summer. With inflation rebounding and growth on a five-year run, the ECB has been removing stimulus for much of this year. This is despite more recent growth indicators appearing to show that the expansion is running out of steam and risks to the outlook are mounting. The bank also made no change to its policy guidance, first formulated in June and kept broadly unchanged through several meetings. The Governing Council expects the key ECB interest rates to remain at their present levels, at least through the summer of 2019, and in any case for as long as necessary, it said, repeating its guidance.
Excellent. Yeah, good news, I'm sure, for people with a mortgage and people with borrowings.
Or any borrowings. If you ever look at fixing your rates, it's generally kind of nearly, you know, you're sort of saying, if I fix it, it goes up quite a reasonable amount. So I remember once I fixed it and it was great because it actually did go above the thing. So sometimes it's worth it. It's worth having a look. But maybe whatever you got now and you had a look at what it might be next year, it may only be 0.25%, but they do have to do it to keep inflation in
check.
In check,
so
exactly.
To speak. Yeah. Okay, we'll take a short break now and I'll be talking to Alana Jeffries about her network marketing business, Forever Living, after this. Take a break, back in a moment.
You're listening to Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM. Every Thursday at 6 p.m, the local, national and international business news headlines with a focus on what affects us here in Northeast Dublin. Regular features on the programme will include the Business Of section, where each week a different industry or industry leader will be here to chat about what makes their business work. The latest tool and technology needed to make sure your business remains at the leading edge. HR issues will be discussed, as well as a particular focus on looking at matters from the employer's point of view. Being an entrepreneur can be a lonely pursuit, so there'll be a regular look at what supports are available for business in the local area. And a host of special features as well. Don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can text while the show is on the air to 087 69 44 500 or at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business. Near FM's business programme is Nearby Business.
and welcome back to Nearby Business. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch while the show is on air, you can text us even to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get us anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz. I'm joined now by Alana Jeffries. She's with me. She's going to chat to me about the success of her network marketing business, Forever Living. Hiya, Alana.
Hi, Declan. How are you? Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome to the programme. Alana, I suppose for people who don't know, and I don't know a lot about it myself, would you explain what a network marketing business is, first of all?
Sure. Okay. Well, the way our business operates is that I'm provided with a product. I work with a company called Forever Living Products, and they supply me with a product which is within the health and wellness industry. So our products are based on aloe vera. And we have a very wide range of products, and I sell those products to a small group of customers that I build up over a period of time. So that's how our business works.
Okay, so it's basically about marketing to a network of people that you know or that you get to know, yeah?
Yes, very much that. Yeah, it's only 20 or 30 customers is all I need to run my business.
Okay, as little as that, yeah?
Yes. That's
excellent.
All, yeah.
Okay, so that's very different from a traditional business, because traditional businesses tend to need more customers, and they tend to have a physical presence somewhere as well, or an online presence. So,
exactly.
Do you have any of that similarity to your business?
It is quite different from the traditional business. Obviously, we don't need to have a shop front, but we still obviously need to work our business on a daily basis. My background has come very much from a traditional business. I've had a lot of chain and beauty salons. I've also had a recruitment business as well. So I needed to open up the shop front every single day. And it didn't actually give me a lot of flexibility, which is what I was looking for when I had my family. So I can pick and choose the hours I work, but obviously I still need to have a structure behind my day. So I need to set myself goals, what I need to achieve, and then I need to look for customers that I think might benefit from our products.
And the fact I'm sure it's difficult enough to get 20 or 30 key customers. Mm. Obviously, there's a big repeat purchase element to the business.
Yeah. Yes. Very much so. And also there is, you know, you have to look after your customers. Customer retention is key.
Yeah.
But obviously that's only one way of us earning an income as well. I do then earn, because it's a network marketing business, I earn an income also by helping other people who are in a similar situation to myself, who are looking for an additional income. And I help them set up their businesses as well. So the company actually pay me a bonus, a team leading bonus, to help my team members build up their business.
Okay, so is there an online element to it at all, or is it all face to face or other methods?
A little bit of both, to be honest. We need to physically go out and meet customers, because also, you know, I am the face of my business. We're all independent business owners, so although I'm provided with the products from Forever Living, I run the business myself, so it is my operation. So for me personally, I like to go out and meet customers. I can meet people at fairs, I can meet people at sports events, I can meet other mums who are looking maybe for additional energy, people who have, who are looking for a natural range of skincare as well. So there's a whole host of areas I can meet people. But obviously there's a huge element of what I can do is online as well, because I did want that flexibility of working around my children. So a lot of what I do is online. And as our business is international as well, we're in 165 countries throughout the world, I can network with people online in other countries as well.
And so tell us a little bit more about Forever Living. It is, as you said there, it's a global business with lots of individual entrepreneurs like yourself. So give us a little feel for how that setup is.
Sure. Well, the company has been established since 1978, so we actually celebrated our 40th birthday there this year. It's an American-based business, and what I loved about the business when I first saw it is that it's still a family-run business to this day. Hugely ethical as well, and they're operating in over 165 countries. Anywhere they open up an office, they tend to buy a building as well. So they have a lot of assets, they're cash rich, and They have a lot of assets in terms of the buildings that they own throughout the world as well. They're vertically integrated, so they actually manufacture and they produce, they actually grow their own aloe vera as well. So they've got the largest plantations in the world in the Dominican Republic. So the world's, we're the world's largest grower of aloe and the world's largest producer of beehive products as well.
Okay. And they're at the core of the products that
they
you sell.
They're the main products. I mean, we would have over 100 products within the range, but essentially all our products are aloe-based. And they're within the health and wellness industry, which is a huge, huge growing. It's a trillion-dollar industry, so it's enormous. So when I saw that, I thought, okay, this is growing exponentially. People are spending a lot more time and very, very aware of what they're putting into their bodies as well. So they're looking for premium products to take. People are going to the gym more. People are living longer. So they're looking for a quality product. And, you know, I loved that element to it.
Okay. Now, you're in the UK. You're talking to us from the UK this evening. But you started the business here in North County Dublin.
I did indeed. Yes, I did. I ran the business from Donna Base in North County Dublin. So I've been running my business just over 3 years now. And the original reason I actually started my business, I've come from a recruitment business background. I was a fashion buyer in the UK. I've taken on a number of different roles previously, but I was looking for something to do around my children. I still wanted to be a working mum, but I wanted to have the flexibility to take them to school and pick them up from school every day. But I had transferable skills that I could utilize in other areas. So I found the business, and I've been running my business ever since. And I knew eventually we'd be moving to the UK because my husband has been commuting from the UK over the last 3 years on a weekly basis. And very, very few businesses would give me that flexibility to transfer my business to a different country. And luckily, when we moved here just over 3 months ago, I was able to do that.
And have you had to establish a new region for your business with new customers, or were you able to keep some of the customers from Ireland, or how does that work? Just curious.
We have a distribution centre actually, which is state-of-the-art one that's just been opened in the Netherlands over the last year, and all of our products are distributed for Europe anyway from that particular hub. So no, I can maintain my customers, and they're still distributed from the Netherlands to my customers. But obviously, at the same time, I want to keep growing my business and constantly are looking for new customers. So I have started to expand my network here also.
Brilliant. Yeah, so it really is irrelevant where you're located. You're able to service people here in North County Dublin from your UK base as well.
Very much so, very much so. And also, obviously, I have my team who have helped to start their businesses in Ireland as well. We have Skype meetings, we have trainings. Everything is online. Obviously, when I started the business, I haven't come from this background.
Sure.
But there's huge support and training and development. Quite a lot of it is done online as well. But also what I've found as well, a lot of people who are working for larger corporations, they're just not getting the recognition that they once got many, many years ago. They're just another wheel in the cog. And people are looking for that now. They're looking for more career development. They're looking for recognition. And because this is an American company, they do that really, really, really well. So, you know, it's when you first join, they get you to set your goals and do up goal boards, which initially I was like, this is very strange.
This is all strange to me. Yeah.
But it's great. It keeps you on task and it keeps you very, very focused.
Focused, yeah.
And ultimately, it gives you the time freedom that a lot of people are looking for. You know, people are sick of the commute. You know, I was living in Dublin, and even driving my kids to school was horrendous when it was raining. So, you know, people are looking for a different quality of life. And, you know, this is one of the businesses I've found that can actually give me that. You know,
and briefly, Alana, for what do you see in the future for the business and for yourself?
I want to expand globally. There's an author called Robert Kiyosaki who wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and he calls the network marketing business the business of the 21st century. So I think there'll be a lot of people who are coming from all different backgrounds. We have people who are nurses, who are doctors. We have film producers, all different walks of life who were looking at this business as a vehicle to give them the freedom, the additional income for their pensions, and, you know, to also help their children's education, to pay for their third level education. So I can see this being a huge vehicle for people going forward who are open-minded. And for me, I want to work with those people and I want to expand my business globally.
Alana, we wish you the best of luck from nearby business here at Near FM, and good luck with all your future plans.
Thank you so much, Declan.
Thanks a million. Not at all. Alana Jeffries there telling us about her network marketing business that started here on the north side of Dublin and is now based in the UK. And fair play to her.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Now, Dave, just about time to squeeze one more story in. And Mark Little, he continues to be the golden boy of online media.
Yeah, we spoke about this last year before Christmas. Neva Labs, they set up a new company called Neva Labs. They said they had a holding name or a transitional name they were going to use. And now they're called KinZen. And it's a news app that aims to sift out junk and promote expert news and information from around the web. It plans to do this through the service users around whom the system is based. Experts in their field will share and discuss quality news links in what amounts to a top-down curated organisation. Mark Little and Áine Kerr are the founders who work together at Storyful. Also say that current news publishers may be interested in KinZen, possibly on a subscription partnership.
And the best of luck to him. That is it, unfortunately, for this week for Nearby Business. Thanks a million to all our contributors this evening. We'll both be back with another Nearby Business at the same time next week. In the meantime, don't forget, if you comment or you have an idea you'd like to chat to us about, you can get in touch on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz. So from me, Declan Ralph.
And Dave Daly.
We'll see you soon on the radio. Bye for now. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
From Baldoyle to Beaumont.
Community radio for North East Dublin. 90.3.
90.3.
Near FM.